annual San Fernando Valley AA Convention with Al-Anon and Alateen participation. It's been a wonderful weekend. Before we begin, we ask you to please turn off your cell phones and all electronics or put them on silent. Will you please stand and join me in the Serenity Prayer?
God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Suggested Al-Anon welcome. We welcome you to the Al-Anon family group and hope you will find in this fellowship the help and friendship we have been privileged to enjoy. We live or have lived with the problem of alcoholism, understand as perhaps few others can. We too were lonely and frustrated, but in Al-Anon we discovered that no situation is really hopeless and that it is possible for us to find contentment and even happiness, whether the alcoholic is still drinking or not. We urge you to try our program. It has helped many of us find solutions that lead to serenity. So much depends on our own attitudes, and as we learn to place our problem in its true perspective, we find it loses its power to dominate our thoughts and our lives. The family situation is bound to improve as we apply the Al-Anon ideas. Without such spiritual help, living with an alcoholic is too much for most of us. Our thinking becomes distorted by trying to force solutions, and we become irritable and unreasonable without knowing it. The Al-Anon program is based on the 12 steps, adapted from Alcoholics Anonymous, which we try, little by little, one day at a time, to apply to our lives, along with our slogans and the Serenity Prayer. The loving interchange of help among members and daily reading of Al-Anon literature thus makes us ready to receive the priceless gift of serenity. Anonymity is an important principle of the Al-Anon program. Everything that is said here in the group meeting and member to member must be held in confidence. Only in this way can we feel free to share what is in our minds and hearts, for this is how we help one another in Al-Anon. Anonymity. The principle of anonymity is essential during meetings to assure the confidentiality of who is present and what is shared at the meetings. As time progresses, some members decide to let their membership in Al-Anon be known to professionals in the community so that others can receive Al-Anon's help. Each member chooses when and why he or she lets others outside their meeting know he or she is attending Al-Anon. The principle of anonymity encourages each member to respect the reasons for this personal decision and make no judgments about them. The principle of anonymity acts as a restraint on members at the public level, to assure that no one will use Al-Anon for profit, prestige, or power. This means that at the level of press, radio, films, TV, and the internet, full names and faces of Al-Anon and Alateen members are not used. No Al-Anon member can speak as an authority on Al-Anon in the media. No one's story is more important than another. We are a fellowship of equals, and Al-Anon is a program of principles, not personalities. Out of respect for others, please do not take photographs during any of the meetings at this event. Please be considerate when taking photographs, using care that you do not capture images of Al-Anon, Alateen, AA members, or their guests who did not give their permission and may not wish to appear in your pictures. In the spirit of Tradition 11, please do not post recognizable photos of identifiable Al-Anon, Alateen, AA members, or their guests on websites accessible to the public, including unrestricted pages on social media sites. That's a mouthful. Okay. Very important. Okay. The topic of this meeting is expect more from life than mere survival. And Laurie F., will you please read us the 12 steps?
Hi, I'm Laurie.
Hi, Laurie.
Because of their proven power and worth, AA's 12 steps have been adopted almost word for word by LLM. They represent a way of life appealing to all people of goodwill, of any religious faith, or of none. Note the power of the very words. 1. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. 4. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7. Humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. 8. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we try to carry this message to others and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Thank you, Laurie. And I have asked Celia P. to please read us the 12 traditions.
Hi, I'm Celia.
Hi, Celia.
The traditions that follow bind us together in unity. They guide the groups in their relations with other groups, with AA, and with the outside world. They recommend group attitudes toward leadership, membership, money, property, public relations, and anonymity. The traditions evolved from the experience of AA groups in trying to solve their problems of living and working together. Al-Anon adopted these group guidelines and over the years has found them sound and wise. Although they are only suggestions, Al-Anon's unity and perhaps even its survival are dependent on adherence to these principles. 1. Our common welfare should come first. Personal progress for the greatest number depends on unity. 2. For our group purpose, there is but one authority, a loving God as He may express Himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3. The relatives of alcoholics, when gathered together for mutual aid, may call themselves an Al-Anon family group, provided that, as a group, they have no other affiliation. The only requirement for membership is that there be a problem of alcoholism in a relative or friend. 4. Each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting another group or Al-Anon or AA as a whole. 5. Each Al-Anon family group has but one purpose, to help families of alcoholics. We do this by practicing the 12 steps of AA ourselves, by encouraging and understanding our alcoholic relatives, and by welcoming and giving comfort to families of alcoholics. 6. Our family groups ought never endorse, finance, or lend our name to any outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary spiritual aim. Although a separate entity, we should always cooperate with Alcoholics Anonymous. 7. Every group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Al-Anon 12th step work should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. Our groups, as such, ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. The Al-Anon family groups have no opinion on outside issues, hence our name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need to always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, films, and TV. We need guard with special care the anonymity of all AA members. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles above personalities.
Thank you, Celia. And Dorley G will read us page 266 from Hope for Today.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Dorley. Talking openly and honestly with my family members is difficult and at times downright painful. Oh my God. Saying to people I love that I'm no longer willing to be around their intense negative energy is a frightening experience. Sometimes, I'm afraid I'll have to separate from my family members to maintain my quest for healthy living, especially when they deny and justify their unacceptable behavior. I'm aware that I still want the people I love to change and mature, oh my God, so I can be more comfortable. I am also aware that this may or may not happen. Today, it's okay for me to want this to happen. However, I am slowly learning that trying to change someone else's behavior to suit my needs is an exercise in futility and frustration. Truly profound power and peace lie in the ability to change my behavior to suit my needs. That's for today. With the help of Al-Anon, I can accept people as they are and find serenity, even if I'm the only one who changes. We need to recover, and when we do, we sometimes find that others are motivated to get better too. Thank you.
Thank you, Darlie. Are there any announcements from our convention committee? Okay. Now I have the pleasure of introducing our speaker for this morning, Mary G. Please join me in giving her a warm welcome. Hi, everybody. I'm Mary.
Hi, Mary.
I'm very emotional this morning. The topic is expect more from life than mere survival, but I also want to read the excerpt from Hope for Today that we have in the program. When I focus on my recovery journey, I honor my thoughts and feelings and pay attention to what they have to tell me regarding my path. I attend the spiritual meaning embedded in the minute-to-minute details of my life as I keenly notice the changes I undergo when I stretch myself spiritually by using a slogan, step, tradition. I stay in today. So, I'm going to start with today. Today, I woke up a little bit before 5, and I went downstairs and heated up the coffee, and I went back upstairs, and I read today's pages in 3 daily readers. And I texted them to all the people that I sponsor. And then I played a New York Times game. And then I did my daily writing. I wrote at the top of the page, God, please hear my prayer. And then I wrote whatever God guided me to write. And what I wrote was a letter from someone that sponsored me for 32 years, who is no longer my sponsor. And and I heard some things from her that I needed to hear from her that I never heard from her when she was sponsoring me. And you know, that's the way God works in my life today. In 2017, my husband, who at that time was probably 33 years sober, got a diagnosis of dementia. And I thought it was going to kill me. And, you know, but I have tools. I have tools. And so what I did is I started to really, I initiated this practice that I just told you about. To say, just, I mean, like it was going to save my life, because that's what it was going to do, was save my life. And, because of this tragedy that we experienced, because I'm in Al-Anon and I have a manner of living, a spiritual manner of living, the crisis, you know, like the latest crisis, led me closer to my higher power. And so, and you know, this is not like the first time this has happened. You know, I thought the worst thing in my life was that my husband had alcoholism, but it turned out to be the best thing, because it led me to a spiritual way of life that I did not know I needed. I had a life-threatening disease, and I thought it was the worst thing that ever happened to me, but it was actually the best thing that ever happened to me, because I was unable to show up in people's lives the way I had been showing up in people's lives. And I discovered while I was having that disease that I had an old idea, which was that you would not love me unless I did something for you. And what I found out is people loved me anyway. They loved me and they cleaned my house, you know. They loved me and they gave me rides places. And the other miracle was that I also thought that my family depended on me, that if it was up to me to make all the things happen in my family. It was up to me to make sure that everybody was happy. It was up to me to make sure that everybody was fed. It was up to me to show everybody the right way to live. And I was so sick, I couldn't do that. And for the first time in my life, I let my husband take care of me, my alcoholic husband take care of me. And that was a great feeling. And I could tell that that was a great feeling for him. And it was a great feeling for my son, you know, that I asked him for help and I couldn't do everything. And that was an amazing lesson. And then, you know, I thought that my husband's dementia was the worst thing that ever happened. And in a lot of ways, it was the worst thing that ever happened. Yeah. But in a lot of ways, it was the best thing that ever happened, because I truly could not do it by myself, and I had to ask for help, which is really hard for me. And I had to grow spiritually, and I had to find the strength within me, to carry on. And I also had to feel my feelings. That situation was so challenging, so tragic, so scary. Just to witness someone dissolving in front of my eyes and having things go on that were deeply embedded within me as being wrong, you know. Just to love him so deeply and to recognize that he wasn't there, you know. And I had feelings. I had big feelings. I had big fear. I had big anger. I had big sadness. I had big despair. I had big loneliness. And in some ways, that was the best thing that ever happened to me, you know, because I don't like to feel feelings. I made a decision when I was like 2 that I was going to hold it together, and I did. I held it together for 70 years, you know. And I was powerless. I was having these feelings, and I was showing these feelings, and in a way, it was the best thing that ever happened to me. And my husband died. I wish that death had been different. I was there, and I was holding his hand. But there was an oxygen machine running, and I don't know if any of you know anything about oxygen machines, but they're really loud. And I really regret that his final moments were not peaceful. But there's nothing I can do about that. And then my kids came, and we sat there and waited for several hours for different, you know, legal things to happen. And this is, you know, alcoholism is a family disease. And when I got here, I landed in a group that talked about it as a family disease, and they talked about family recovery, and they, you know, we did all kinds of things with families that were in recovery, and the kids hung out with other kids affected by alcoholism, and, you know, I used to just drag my family to these things, and, you know, and then we'd get there, and the alcoholics would talk to each other and soothe each other, and the kids would run around with each other, and the Al-Anons would soothe each other. And other people's, you know, other alcoholics' Al-Anons would, you know, be surrounding, for instance, my husband, just like... and give him love, you know. And me watching other people love my husband was profound, you know. Because they knew, because I was sharing. And they loved him anyway. And we would come back from those things, and we would be better. Our family would be better. So anyway, my husband died. It took a long time for all this stuff to happen that has to happen. And I was sitting there with my kids, and that's a miracle. You know, we were there. We were there with him. Alcoholism isolates us and separates us from the human job of supporting each other. And because our family had been healed, or was being healed by the programs of Al-Anon and AA and Alateen, you know, we were together, and we could sit there and be there as a family. And we you know, I had learned to be honest, and so I was telling the kids, you know, that the night before I had distracted myself from what was going on by researching my next iPhone for like 2 hours. And I didn't end up buying one, but then my daughter said, "Oh yeah, I bought a tarot deck while I was waiting for the plane to take off." And then my son said, "I just bought this watch, see?" And that's crazy. That's a miracle. That's a miracle. So my husband died, and I am in a condition to explore the land of grief, and it's a real privilege to do that. It's kind of an extension of what I've been doing here for 39 years, you know. What this says is that no matter what happens, I can grow spiritually if I apply the program. And so my husband died, and at first I was just like so relieved that that part of our life was over, you know, because that was a part of our relationship that neither of us really wanted, you know. And it's over. And we were together for 50 years, so that part is over. And I still have all the other 50 years, you know. But after a while, I was rested. And the shock had kind of worn off. And I started to explore my grief. And here's the thing. That's not the only grief I've ever had, you know? I mean, something happened when I was 2 that was very sad for me. I always thought that I was unlovable. There was something wrong with me as a result of this thing. And that impacted my life. I had very, very good, well-intentioned, diligent, loving parents, but in very significant ways, they were not able to be there for me, and that's a grief, you know. As a result of having my parents, I was completely shut down emotionally. I could not reach the part. I could not reach myself. I really did not know what was going on. I was really focused on creating an image of self-confidence and ease. And when I got to college, I was confronted with a situation where I could not handle it. Like, I could not handle the coursework, and I could not handle the amount of freedom that I had. And I didn't know what to do about that. I just didn't know what to do. And what happened was I started to distract myself with risky behavior. Can I have my water? Mm-hmm. I graduated high school in 1969, and the world was on its head, you know, it was on its head, I went to this little college in the Midwest, and I started hitchhiking. And I felt like it just was this grand adventure, and it was, you know, it was meant to be, and it was, you know, it felt really good, the freedom and the ability to move around and see things I'd never seen before and experience things I'd never experienced before. And it just seemed like what I should do. And my parents were out of the country. My dad took a job overseas. There was nobody here. I wouldn't have known how to ask for help in any case, but whatever, they weren't here. And I ended up going to, you know, when it was school break, I went to where they were in Indonesia, and I met this kid who was the son of a colleague of my dad's, and he was an alcoholic. You know, we were kids. We were like 19, and he had already suffered a lot of the consequences of uncontrolled drinking. But I didn't know anything about that. It wasn't a secret, but I didn't know what that meant, you know, that he got kicked out of school and had a couple of car accidents and what have you. But I saw, first of all, he's really smart, and I really like smart people. But also, I saw in him this wildness that was attractive to me. And he was planning to hitchhike around the world. And I thought that was great. I mean, you know... And so I said that I was going to take a semester off of school, and we were gonna travel around the world. And this is where I started to have Al-Anonism. We were going to meet in Washington, D.C., which is where he was from. And I went there, and I found a place to live, and I found a little job, and I waited for him, and I waited, and I waited, and I waited, and I waited way longer than it was reasonable, you know. And eventually he came, and we packed up to go on this trip. We packed up our backpacks, you know. and including a big jar of vitamin B capsules that we dumped out and replaced with LSD. And off we went. And off we went. And it was... It was the best thing that had ever happened to me. I loved the freedom, and I loved seeing things I'd never seen before. And, you know, I loved meeting people that were different from me, and I loved, I mean, really different from me. People, I mean, eventually, you know, we went across Europe and around the Mediterranean, down into Africa, and I mean, really different from me, and it was like a fairy tale, you know. And I don't really regret it, but it did set me on a path that gave me trouble, you know, down the road. And you know, there used to be a line in our literature that said, we become sick too. And I think they've changed that a little bit, but I became sick too. I wasn't raised in alcoholism. I was an immature, sort of emotionally crippled person, but I was not affected by alcoholism. But when I was in that relationship, I was affected by alcoholism, and I started to have the symptoms of the non-drinker's, you know, disease. And I started, you know, I was in charge of everything. I was doing the banking. I took responsibility for everything. And I also, you know, he blamed me for everything. And I started to, as was my, you know, the way I dealt with things, I just continued to do it. I started to keep secrets. I started to not admit that I had made a mistake. I started to hide, you know, the problems that I was having, whatever they might be. Back then, you know, we didn't have ATMs, we had traveler's checks. And you bought these checks at a bank, you paid cash for these checks at a bank, you signed the top of it, and then you saw, when you wanted to cash it in for money, you signed it at the bottom. And I went off to do that as my Al-Anon duty, and got to the bank and realized I had taken his traveler's checks and I had signed my name on the bottom. And it, you know, like, I can't admit I make a mistake. I can't ask for help. I assumed that that meant that those checks were, like, now just trashy pieces of paper. They weren't worth anything. I couldn't tell him. I mean, I don't even know how much money it was, maybe $100. I couldn't tell him I made a mistake. I couldn't tell the banker. I ended up ripping up those traveler's checks and, like, trashing them somewhere, you know? And this is, I mean, this is how I was learning. This is how I was evolving. I was evolving into an Al-Anon. We came back to the United States. He got worse. He got more volatile. He got more violent. He killed a cat, his best friend, so a very sweet owl man, rescued me, and I went to live in a big old Victorian house in Washington, D.C. with a bunch of other kids. And somebody there told me that being a cocktail waitress was a really good job. And so I looked in the want ads, and I found this, you know, I answered this ad, and I went into the place, and And I lied and said that I knew how to be a waitress, which I did not. Not only that, my parents were teetotalers. I knew nothing, zero, zip about drinks. But whatever. And it was the best job I ever had. Well, I can't say that, actually, but I loved it. I loved that job. It was mostly men that came into this bar. I was waitressing by myself 4 days a week, and they were all, you know, I was like 22. They were all flirting with me. I loved it. And again, it was like this adventure, you know. Washington, D.C., I mean, journalists from the Washington Post came in, you know. A guy that was setting up telephones in the Pentagon came in. Congressmen, cab drivers, cat burglars, heroin addicts. I mean, it was incredible. And one day this guy walked in and stood next to the waitress station and said, "You are so pretty. You are so pretty." And I thought, if he thinks I'm so pretty, maybe everything is going to be okay. We were together until February 11th, 2024. I had just gotten back from a trip around the world. I thought it was the best thing ever. And he had a friend his longest friend, who was in Mexico. And I encouraged him to quit his job and go see his friend in Mexico. And he did. He was gone, you know. He was gone. I was in his apartment in Washington, D.C. After a while, I got tired of just being up there, you know, by myself. And I went to meet him in Cabo San Lucas, and I found out that this friend of his and some other guys were smuggling hash oil into the United States in a truck with a camper van on the back of it. And I knew that was wrong. I mean, it's not that wrong. I mean, it's legal now, but I knew that doing something illegal was not a good idea, right? But I couldn't speak up for myself, and I couldn't risk losing. You know, alcoholics all the time talk about how they take that first drink, and then they're like, oh, this is the answer. Now I'm comfortable. That's how I was with my alcoholic. He was my solution to my living problems. He was handsome and funny and always doing stuff and surrounded by people. And he was my solution. And so I got in this situation where bad stuff was happening and I couldn't give him up, you know? I had to go along, and I just used my favorite tool, you know. I just lied about it to myself. I lied to myself and said, well, you know, these are my people. These are the people that travel around the world and do risky things and whatever. I just got on board. And I, you know, I've done so much work in this program, and I know today that I was already isolated. I had already put myself outside the edge of, you know, society. I was already unlovable to myself. And this lifestyle, this outlaw lifestyle, was just like an outward expression of what had already happened within me, you know. We couldn't talk on the telephone. We moved every 9 months. We put the DWP in some fictitious name. When I got here, our home phone number was in the name of, I remembered it just the other day, Dan Albert. Our phone was in the name of Dan Albert. And it remained that way until we started using cell phones. I mean, our home phone number was in the name of Dan Albert. And I couldn't have people at the house. I couldn't really... I used to send my parents letters every now and again without a return address. I mean, it was alcoholism. And things got worse, you know, things got worse. When we got here, my 9-year-old was running the house. My 6-year-old, 5-year-old was going to his bed and putting the covers over his head when any danger seemed to be imminent. My relationship with Jack had become violent. At least 50% of it was that I would not get out of the way when things were, you know, when things were getting bad. He would say to me, "Mary, get away from me. Mary, get away from me." And I wouldn't go. I had a therapist who never mentioned Al-Anon and never mentioned AA, but she gave me a number to give to Jack if Jack ever wanted to get sober, or whatever, she didn't say sober, ever wanted to stop, right? So of course, he never called. I called the number. And it was a psychiatrist, and he said he couldn't help me, but he gave me the number of somebody else, and that person said that, listened to my story, and told me that my family had the disease of alcoholism, which was news to me. And he said that the kindest, most compassionate thing I could do for my husband was to let him have his disease, but that I could go and I could take my children and we could get well. And I've said, you know, Jack was my solution to my living problems, and I really think that my kids saved my life, because I'm not sure if it was just Jack and me, if I would have changed. But I could see that my children were hurting, and I wanted them to be well. And so I went to Jack and I told him that we had alcoholism and that we could get help. And he said, I do know that I'm drinking too much, but nobody can help me. But I see that I have to leave. So he left. He drove his Porsche to Alaska. And while he was gone, I went to an Al-Anon meeting. And it was a It was at St. Joe's Hospital. And it was a candlelight meeting, and it was a speaker meeting. And so the meeting started, you know, and I was sitting in the back, of course, and people started saying their names, and I just was like, oh no, like, I don't think I can do this. And I brought to mind my former risky self, right? And I thought, okay, I have taken $100,000 in cash across international borders. I can say my name. And so when it came to be my name, you know, time to say my name, I did manage to say my name. And the speakers, there were two speakers, an AA and an Al-Anon, two women. And the Al-Anon woman said that she had Al-Anon ears. And what that was is that she could hear her alcoholic's car a mile away. And I knew what she was talking about. And the other woman shared, the alcoholic actually, shared that she had kids and that they were in Alateen. And if the kids, on the night when it was Alateen night, if the kids said that they were too sick and they couldn't go, she would say, you know, there's a tin can under the sink. Y'all go get it. And if you have to throw up in the can. But you're going to go to Alateen. So this became very useful down the road. and I just never really looked back, you know. Jack came home. And he wanted to, he was talking about who was going to get the, who was going to get what car and who's going to get the house and what's going to happen with the kids and everything. And I called a woman, she was actually a nurse at St. Joe's who was also an Al-Anon, and told her what was going on. And then she just told me what to say, and I just said whatever she said, you know. She said, you tell him you're not talking about divorce, you're talking about recovery. And I had no idea. Like, I didn't know what that meant, but I said it. And then I think she got somebody on the line who talked to Jack or something, but I don't really remember that part. But he did call me at 2:30 that morning after the bars closed and said that he was really sick and he was ready to go into the hospital. And you know, he did, and did their 28-day program and everything. One of his counselors there told him that it was unlikely that he was going to make it because of his arrogance. And, you know, I really... I got to hand it to him, you know. I mean, he was arrogant, and he was hip, slick, and cool. And he, by the grace of God, you know, did what had to be done to basically stay with us. And we started to build a life. How much time have I got?
So you've got 50 seconds before 15
minutes. Okay, great. Perfect. Okay. And what we did is we just got into it, you know. The kids were 6 and 10. They went to preteen. Friday night at Valley Prez, there was an AA meeting, an Al-Anon meeting, an Alateen meeting, a pre-Alateen meeting, and babysitting. And we went there every week, and, you know, Zoe, my daughter, says that after she'd been going for a couple of weeks, she told a joke, and everybody laughed. And so, you know, she was in. She was in. Caleb, my son, had a, you know, hid under the covers, and And always, if I would say to him, "Hey, buddy, what's going on?" he would like burst into tears. But he went to Prealatine, and he started to be able to name his feelings. You know, I feel scared. I feel anxious. I feel worried. He never taught me, well, whatever. I never went to the Alateen meetings, but the Alateen sponsor told me that he didn't really share, but he wasn't disruptive either, so he could stay, because of course he was welcome, but she wasn't sure if he was getting anything, but I knew that he was, because he could talk about himself. Thank God for Alateen sponsors, I'm telling you, because we needed help raising those kids. We were sick, and we didn't have to do it alone. You know, we had those Alateen sponsors. So much happens in 39 years, you guys. My daughter is brilliant, and she wanted to go to college. And, you know, once we got done with the drug smuggling, my husband didn't exactly have a resume that would get him a job anywhere. And we suffered, you know. One of the effects of alcoholism for some people is, you know, you just can't make a living, you know. And I was a college dropout. I mean, so her prospects for a college education depended squarely on her own shoulders. And we were able to walk through that because of Al-Anon, you know. I was able to say, you know, Zoe, this school that you want to go to costs what I make in a year, so it's going to be God's will, right? And that was a language that she could understand, you know, and we just walked through it. We just paid for, like, one college application at a time or whatever it was. And she got to go to college. And, you know, you guys, Al-Anon walked me through that. Our son was not a good student. He's very smart also, but not in the do good in school way. And, you know, the universe took care of him too. He really got lit up by his shop class. And one day there was a guy there who was recruiting for a technical school, and he just took a liking to my son, and Caleb was in Alateen, and he had learned to, you know, he had learned the self-esteem giving act of earning the money that he placed in the basket every week. You know, he was like, the money that I put in the basket is my money, and he was able to take a risk and go to this school. Jack and I found ourselves in a situation where we didn't have any kids, and we had a good relationship. We got along, you know, we had fun with each other, we loved each other, we liked each other, and we had years where we were living our best life. And you know, I had dropping out of school really broke my heart. My parents had humanitarian ideals, you know. We're supposed to have a life with purpose and do good and everything. And then I had this, like, dissolute life. You know, but God took care of me because my life had purpose. I'm incredibly grateful for that. That is a miracle that God can take